Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI, Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. The center of Ames, the center of Iowa, the center of it all. And we are proud and really happy to be part of the community radio family at this station. It's a fun place to be. Yes, it is. Well, Donna, it feels like fall. I've seen some trees actually.
I saw my first orange tree this morning.
A whole orange tree? You just...
It was probably one of those crab apples that turns really, okay. You know, it was a short tree. Yeah, a short tree, but it was all the right color. So I went, here we go.
I've been noticing the maples kind of turning and the honey locust leaves are fluffing down. It's about time. And Donna, so what's with this wet stuff that was falling from the sky this morning?
I don't know what that was. I couldn't recognize it at all last night. It's been so long since I've seen anything wet come out of the sky. I was like, whoa.
It's welcome. There was a bit of a little thunderstorm kind of went through early this morning, and a pleasant one it was. Yes, it was. It's feeling like fall. It's feeling like a little bit of wetness, and I have a little bit of a garden update. I've been busy putting food by because the garden is just kind of in its production stage now, and it's a good thing. I like okra because we have okra this year. And Donna, we're both to the stage where, believe it or not, we can say, peaches, please, no more peaches.
Well... Yeah, after first going, oh, there's not going to be any peaches this summer because in Georgia it was a complete bust, and South Carolina the same thing, and the early stuff was not in the markets, and then the local peaches, which
Iowa
we don't,
peaches.
Yeah, Iowa peaches, who knew, right?
Yeah,
right. So my peach tree in my backyard, which had never produced more than 10 nothing burgers, was so loaded that the branches are breaking off, and this week we're going to have to cut it down and pick the fruit.
Yeah, it's just almost kind of over the top. I mean, peach trees are going really well here. There's a couple of different Iowa varieties. Some are really lovely and tasty, and other ones you may be a little surprised at their subtlety, but they are
subtlety
peaches.
is the right word. And, you know, I mean, one thing I am reminded once again when I see the bounty that comes from having your own anything, tree or garden or whatever, and then the things that you can do with preserving. Like the amount of peaches that we have had this summer, if you were to want to make some of the things that we have made, the frozen, the different kinds of preserves, and I think I have so many peaches, I think I'm just going to make jelly, which I never do. But the reminder in my reptilian brain is, oh yeah, this is why people used to do these homemaking processes, because if I had to go out and buy that many peaches, I would never in my right mind do that. Peaches were sometimes $4 a pound this summer. Ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I mean, not to begrudge the farmers, but our whole system is so upside down that that's what they have to get to grow it, pick it, and send it from wherever, whereas when it's in your backyard and they're falling on the ground so much that, you know, I mean, one of the funniest sights last week was seeing this fat squirrel hanging over the branch with a peach as big as his head in his mouth and then scrambling up and squirreling it off, as squirreling is a verb, right, somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's just hilarious.
The squirrel was putting things by for winter, too.
Well, I hate to tell him, but those peaches aren't going to last the same way the acorns are, but whatever.
Well,
it's a beautiful thing.
We're dealing with the bounty. Yes, we are. Well, Donna and I both like books, and I love all kinds of books.
Books and food, and then books about food, right?
But then we got food books. Yes, books about food, but then cookbooks, and Well, we both have a stash of cookbooks, and we're the kind of women that we'll just sit down and read a book about food. Just kind of read through a recipe and see what it feels like. And we often,
as opposed to not that I don't read recipes on the internet, I do, but we're a little I'll call it discerning. It could be flat out judgmental, but you know, I've cooked enough things from books and the internet and making it up in my head that when I read something, I'm, you know, my detector is going, nah, I don't think so. Or so when we find a book that we like, we get really excited.
Yes. Donna, we have a book to talk about that is just a real winner. Tell us about this book, Donna.
We should qualify it by saying the kind of books we like and why we like them. This book, it's called The Miracle of Salt, Recipes and Techniques to Preserve, Ferment, and Transform Your Food. It's by Naomi Duguid, D-U-G-U-I-D. I have been reading her books for many years, and there are, you know, lots of them. She has been all over the world documenting cuisines and writing recipes and taking gorgeous photographs and stuff like that. And I have a number of her books because she's good. She's a good food writer. She's a really good explainer. It's like her instructions are really, really helpful. And that's why I got so excited about this book, because it's a technique book. Or, you know, gives me what I call new tricks. And, you know, my idea is a trick is not something that's fooling someone, but an extra little culinary technique that helps me push flavors further in ways that I find interesting. You know, I mean, we don't want to get dull here. We want to, you know, keep trying new things and fooling around all the time. So this book has a lot of things that I had been fiddling with here and there. And, of course, there's, you know, fermentation has been the hot new thing for the last 5 years. And I have a lot of the other books. This book, she's got it because she's such a good teacher.
Yes, yes. I can read that book. In between all of the teaching, there's, of course, Donna mentioned, beautiful pictures and travel notes and what she's learned from around the world. But when it comes right down to here's how you do it, it's a joy. It's a joy to read.
Let's use it as an example. If any of you were listening to us last year about this time, we were going through a thing where we had discovered fermented tomatoes because our friend Gio from the Republic of Georgia had introduced us to what is Eastern European thing of pickled tomatoes or fermented tomatoes or brined tomatoes, as she calls it. And we bought some at the what we call the Russian store in Des Moines, where they have a lot of Eastern European products. And they were revelatory to me. And so we spent a lot of time trying to figure out, looking for recipes, going online, looking at recipes, you know, this, that, and the other, trying to figure out how to do it. And we did some of it, and it was okay, but it was a little confusing, and it was definitely experimental. So I opened, and we looked at some Ukrainian cookbooks, too, and all of them, you know, it just still wasn't clear to me how to do it.
A lot of it has to do with people have been doing it for so long. They'd say, oh, you know, just put them in a jar and add some salt. You know, because they've been doing it for years and years, and their grandmother's been doing it for years and years.
Exactly.
And so there's things that maybe Donna and I here in Iowa kind of miss. So.
Well, and I mean, this is the thing I love about this cookbook writer. She really is a pro at the writing part and the explaining part. So in her brined tomato recipe, I will just read a little bit. This distinct Eastern European take on tomatoes is a very simple way to make a refreshingly delicious accompaniment to a meal. And then she talks about there's many versions. Brined tomatoes preserved by fermentation without vinegar are a distinctive food, a great way to extend the summer. You can vary the flavor. Some versions include a little chili, allspice, parsley, or celery. Some add a splash of vinegar, which was confusing to me when I was trying to figure out this. And then She says, I like using several sizes and colors of tomatoes because that makes the jars look, they do look beautiful when you're, then she talks about, because she has written books and been to the Republic of Georgia. She said, on one of my trips to Georgia, her friend took me to visit the grandmother of the friend. She had been a noted scientist, but with the fall of the Soviet Union, she, like other academics and highly skilled professionals, lost her job and her pension. By the time I met her, she was in her 80s, and still every year she preserved fruits and vegetables for the winter, including many jars of tomatoes. Now, here's where she gets to the technique kind of thing that I like. If you love fizzy fermentation, the slight funk of kombucha, for example, you'll want to let your tomatoes ferment for longer before you seal the jars. I like less fizz, so I usually stop the process after 3 days. Now, that's really, really clear. I had no idea, of course, about those variations. Now, we ended up with more fizz, which was one kind of flavor, but she deals with that. These are options that you can, and she explains why. She says, after three days, store the jars in the refrigerator, label and dated. The tomatoes should be within 2 months. But then she also goes on how to do it if you want more fizz and things like that. And then she just says, no matter what you're doing, I use the ratio for the brine, 1.5 teaspoons of salt or 9 grams. And she talks about measuring salt. We'll talk about that later, to a cup of water. And then she just says what she puts in. And then she's got a whole nother page about how to do it. So it was like reading this clarified the multiple recipes that I had to search out on the internet. And it was not easy, and we did it and we figured it out. And I now have better understanding. But if I'd had her book last year, it would have helped a lot.
This idea of salt, we take it for granted, salt. Okay, we can do that. But after reading this book, and actually after kind of going down to the line in the grocery store, you realize there's lots of different kinds. There's different kinds, and they all have different weight. They have different densities. And she talks about different saltiness in there, too, how salty things can be.
Well, I mean, she starts from the premise that we often forget that before refrigeration and chemicals and all of those things, salting and air drying were the main, you know, preserving techniques that people used. Ancient times, you know, archaeologists are still trying to figure out how people dealt with this, and they have identified the various things that when they stumble on it, oh yeah, this was for, you know, because people, there's several ways salt comes, and not every place on the planet has salt, but of course seawater is very salty. There are certain places where there are salt water springs that just come up because during the formation of the earth, various times there were oceans, salty oceans in different places on the planet, some of which are now like deserts or, you know, or like the Great Salt Lake or something. Like, why is that salty?
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of these salt deposits are now underground because they're ancient ocean beds. So there's salt mining, and there's, you know, different ways that people have historically done it. And some of them are still doing that. I mean, the most famous Western one is off of the coast of Brittany in the western part of France. There are famous kinds of like the Gironde salt, you know, salt marshes where they still rake it up on shore and let it dry in the sun. Because either you have to dry it with solar evaporation or you have to use some kind of fuel and heat. And she talks about there are whole civilizations where they cut down so many trees to dry the salt out because salt was like, it was used for money. It was traded everywhere early, early, early. Salt is, you know, salt of the earth. What is that? The salt of the earth is the most common, solid, good kind of person is a salt of the earth person. So she talks about measuring weight, salt. And this is just common sense. Okay, if you're using a flaky salt with a large crystal, the weight A teaspoon of that kind of salt is not going to be as heavy as a teaspoon of finely ground, very dense salt.
See, all this was news to me. I thought salt is salt. No, it has a lot to do with the crystals, how it shows up, whether it's really finely ground or flaked or even a chunky.
And the crystals part. Come from the way it's dried. Yeah. So, like, the famous French one was just called the fleur de sel, which is flower of the salt, is made by scraping the top surface crystals off, which are larger and finer, and they're very delicate, and that is a flaked kind of salt structure. It's really simple. There are two things you can think about when you're doing which kinds of salt you want. If you're just cooking with it, you use the finer salts, right? If you want something, I'll give an example. You know how I make my fudge every Christmas? The last few years I have taken to, at the end of it, I just sprinkle a few of the larger flaked salt crystals on, because when you eat those, it will give a crunch in your mouth. You don't want the big ones to dissolve. That's when you use those big ones. It would be a waste to, you know, throw that stuff in the cooking pot for spaghetti water or something like that. So people have begun, it's become a little fashionable to expect that salted, crunchy thing, like on top of if you're making a focaccia, you can sprinkle it on the top. There are a lot of sweet and salty things that people are doing. Like a lovely thing that's so simple. Everybody should try this once, because you'll be shocked how good it is. You take a really good dish of vanilla ice cream, you know, a couple scoops there, pour over it like a tablespoon or so of really rich fruity olive oil, and then sprinkle a few of those coarse fleur de sel crystals on top of it. It's so exotic.
Not that I have yet to do that.
You can go home and do it for lunch. You know,
I mean, who would have thought?
I know. It's but that the salt just, well, and the combination of the olive oil and the sweet. So you've got that sweet salty kind of thing going on with the bitterness, slight bite of the olive oil. So simple, but it's the salt that sets it up like that.
Oh, how wonderful!
Actually, Lana, I gave you a box of flaky salt for your birthday a year or so ago.
And I have used it on things like brownies.
Yes.
And focaccia and, and you know, quick bready stick things. Huh?
Yeah. It's like a topping salt. You just kind of fling it on a little bit, and you don't, you know, you handle it very delicately because you don't want to crush the crystals. You just lightly scatter it.
Peanut brittle and almond brittle, too. Sprinkle, sprinkle.
And that's that sweet, salty thing.
The sweet, salty. Good idea. This book has lots of information about salt. It's so good. Our bodies really need salt. Donna mentioned the fact that it was like gold. Well, it still is like gold. We need salt. So human beings have been using this stuff for a long time, and let's see.
Right, she has a whole bunch in the back of the book called Some Salt Chemistry, and she talks about, you know, what is it you're looking for?
Salt in our 336, page 369.
Okay, one more.
So what our body needs.
Yes, salt in our bodies.
Yeah, we need that stuff, And so,
it's sodium chloride. You need
essential for humans and animals, because it controls fluid balance and facilitates nerve and muscle function. Salt accounts for 0.4% of our body weight. How about that?
That's pretty big when you think about it.
Our body is particularly salty, about 9% salt. When we lack salt, our saliva changes, it becomes less salty, and we don't generally consume salt to maintain our 4% or whatever.
But you think
for taste.
Like you think of first aid for sunstroke.
Mm-hmm.
Salty water, dehydration, something, you know, get your electrolytes up, you know, Gatorade. Well, you know,
salty lemonade works really well, too.
Aha! Very good.
You know,
very good. Gatorade, yes, it does. Good, good.
And she has another, this, there's so much information in here that's not just recipes. Of course, the recipes are terrific, too, but she talks about the different kinds. So the Morton's salt that you buy at the grocery store has what they call anti-caking agents in it. That's so that, you know, the picture has always been the little girl with the umbrella. Mm-hmm. When it rains, it pours, which is because high humidity area can make the salt clump together and not work. So that's been one of their big selling things for the last 75 years, probably. However, another trick is if you live in a really high humidity area, we used to do this when the Midwest was humid, right? Like in your salt shaker, you put a few grains of rice because the rice will absorb the humidity and then the salt doesn't stick together. She does make it very clear that she does not use salt with additives. Actually, neither do I. I always use sea salt. But she does say she has something she calls pickling salt. And I'm thinking, okay, what is she talking about? Pickling salt is any salt that has none of these anti-caking additives, because the additives that they put in for that affect the pickling process and make your vegetables more mushy. So she says not to use those kinds of commercial salts.
Or iodine, which they used to put in, because we weren't getting enough iodine, so it was an idea to put it in salt.
Well, and that has been globally a really effective thing in it for people with diets, because if you don't get enough iodine, and there are places on the planets where the soils don't contain enough of that mineral, that it's not, doesn't go into the vegetables, and people used to develop these things called goiter, and it was a serious health issue globally. Till they started, they just said, oh, everybody uses salt, we'll put iodine in the salt, and now, globally, goiter is no longer really, really a public health problem. So,
good idea.
If you live in a place where that's important, it is a good idea. But many cooks, she says today, in affluent societies prefer not to use iodized salt, knowing that they can get enough iodine from other sources, which I would say seaweeds are a really good way to get those minerals. So she has a lot of that kind of, then she talks about how it's mined and evaporated and gorgeous pictures of different places in the earth where the salt has solar evaporation in, she has a place in, I think it's Peru, where there's some salt spring that comes out of the mountain and they've built terraces going down, you know, where they do that solar evaporation. I mean, these are ancient methods that they still are effective today. So it's a wealth of information about that, even if you're not cooking with it.
Yeah, the pictures in this book tell.
Oh, right.
This
is one from Gujarat, which is one of the places where they have these salt
beds. There's something
beds.
Called the salt pans.
Salt pan is what it's called.
In Gujarat, in the Great Ran of Kutch, Kutch. There, again, the salt comes up. It's in the water. And people gather
seawater,
seawater by raking it up. And so she's got great pictures of this, of course. And here's a little bit what she says about it. March, the air was burning hot, yet the women working in the salt ponds were barefoot, standing a few inches deep in the brine. It does not look very good. But here, of course, there's this picture of the woman raking it up. It looks like she's shoveling snow, actually. The salt workers live in small encampments nearby while they work. And the salt season is from February to May. The working conditions are tough and the pay low. Here we go, all the time. What they harvest is the salt many others depend on. I think of the salt workers like them often when I pick up a pinch of salt.
Well, she talks about, okay, that's in India. Mm-hmm. But the technique that they show in the picture is very similar to the one that the French people do. And believe me, the French are much more well paid than the Indians doing this. It, you know, it is a traditional way, and those French salts
can be pretty pricey for a good reason. Then she talks about in Peru, the one that I was just describing, she said originally the conquistadores had the Peruvians as their slaves making the salt, right?
Yeah.
And then it's only since, I believe, 1990 that the actual peasants who the indigenous people of that land have each been given ownership of their own salt pan. For thousands of years, they were slaves to have to do this, and now they can. But the harvesting technique is still the same.
We all depend on salt. This is KHOI Community Radio, and listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Donna Lana Kitchen, we're talking about salt today. Salt, as we found out so much about in a book called The Miracle of Salt by Naomi Duguid. I'd say Duguid, but it could be Duguid. I don't know. D-U-G-U-I-D. I'd say Duguid. Okay. Donna, Donna, so much good stuff there. So, what are some of the things you can, that salt is applied to
some
here?
Of the recipes, and there's, you know, main dishes and things that you can cook, but she kind of goes through the book and takes it by, let me look at the table of contents here. Yeah, the salt larder, she talks about, so things that you make in advance that you add to your food, like preserved lemons, we'll talk about that, and preserved onions, and things that you kind of work on a little bit and you have either sitting in the refrigerator waiting to add a flavor, or then she also talks about like how to preserve certain fish. Like there's a gravlax recipe in there, which is really easy to make and everybody should try it once.
I love the word gravlax. It doesn't sound like anything you'd eat, but there it is.
Yeah, all it is you have a fresh salmon fillet and you pack it in salt and kind of weight it down and wrap it up and let it sit for, I don't know what she's got, but usually from 12 to 24 to even 2 days, you know, then you take it off and it's like the stuff you buy in the store, only better. So she's got some other fish preserving things and actually how to make your own fish sauce if you're really, really serious. Eggs and poultry. We're going to go through. Lana and I have an egg thing we want to try. Meats. And the preserving techniques for meats, that's pretty sophisticated stuff. But the way she breaks it down, it makes me think, yeah, maybe, you know, I'm going to try this with a pork belly again and things like that. And then sweets, we'll get to that in a minute. Let's start with a recipe that I liked, which I have made before. She calls it salt preserved lemons. In French, it's known as citron confit. Really, all it is you're packing lemons and lemon juice into a jar with salt, and you let it sit for at least a month in the refrigerator. Now, I've done it. The traditional way is you cut the lemons into quarters and you don't cut it all the way through, so you kind of end up with a tulip. So the base of it still sticks together, and then you pack the salt in and you stick them in the jar. She has a better technique where she just slices them. You can fit more in that way. I'm gonna give that a try. I haven't done it for a long time. Actually, she didn't mention this, but somewhere I had a recipe where you put them, you use a freeze-thaw cycle. You put them in a plastic bag in the freezer, then you take them out and thaw them, because the freezing breaks down the wall of the salt too.
That'd be good. Okay, so what do you use this? I have run across recipes for, oh, and then get out your salt preserved lemon. Oh, and I never have one. So what would I use it for?
It's common in like Moroccan foods and North African foods. What my favorite, if I'm making homemade hummus, I throw, you know, when you're running the food processor to mash it all up, I throw in a bunch of lemon. Oh. The salt preserved lemon really makes it go poom. It's delicious. But it's also used like, or you can use it, like if you wanted to do a chicken saute, cut little pieces of preserved lemon and throw them in. It adds, remember if you're adding those things to reduce the amount of salt that we put, because that is carrying the salt into the recipe. But there are many, many, things that you can do with them. And her recipe is, it says they're very versatile pantry staple available to give flavor to anything from sauces to roast chicken to cake. So she's got a cake recipe in here. And she uses regular lemons. I have done it also, particularly the freezing method, with Meyer lemons. Oh, my goodness. But, you know, their skin is more delicate, so it's a wonderful flavor, but you kind of have to watch the timing. She's also got in here, a recipe for salted red onions that I was thinking of trying. These are more like condiments that, she says salt tames onions, which we all like doing. Vinegar also will do that in a quick, like sometimes if I want to put raw onions in a salad, mm-hmm. I'll chop them up and put the vinegar and let them sit for 10 minutes. She says salt tames onions. They sweeten and soften and lose most of their raw pungency and become very useful and adaptable ingredients. Salted onions add flavor to sandwiches, to various dishes garnished as they can take center stage in a Central Asian style salad. So her idea is just to, 2 cups of thinly sliced red onions and the coarse salt. Place the onions in the colander, sprinkle the salt, massage it into the onions a little with your fingertips. Set the colander over a bowl to catch the drips for 20 minutes. Then you rinse the onions and thoroughly squeeze and pat dry.
Oh,
then,
you rinse it? Okay.
Yeah. You want to get, that's more salt than you want on your palate. Okay. So you rinse it off. Then you transfer to a container and store in the refrigerator for up to 2 days before using. So, I mean, that's a quick recipe as opposed to the lemons, which take a month to do.
That's great.
And the tomatoes, which we talked about, which also take a little bit of time. Then, here's the egg one.
Okay, this is something else. Go for it.
Yeah, we're going to. She has two different egg ones. So first I'm going to try, it's just the yolks, but she also has one that you do in the shell. Now, since Lana has wonderful eggs right from her own chickens, we will get around to doing this. This one is called the quick salted egg yolks. It's not that quick, but you just use the yolks, and what you're ending up doing is drying them out and then aging them to the point where they're kind of like a little round piece of Parmesan cheese.
Yeah.
So you grate them onto things the way you would Parmesan for a little more umami, as they say. So I'm just dying to do this. It's in the picture, she's just got a bowl or a pan. It's more flat, and she's got filled with salt, and you just take the egg yolk and you lay it into the salt and then completely cover it with salt. Spread a thick layer of salt. She's got it down. Make 4 hollows in the salt, right? So when you put the egg in, they don't roll in together. Each one is separate. And then you, when they have firmed up, which is about a week, remove from the salt and brush off the remaining salt and wipe it off with a damp cloth. They're that firm, if you can imagine. And wipe the yolks dry. Then you put a large piece of cheesecloth on the work surface, and you space them out. You don't want them touching each other. And you tie a string. So you've got this little log.
Make like a sausage out of it.
Yeah, but with a little string between each one so they stay separate. And then you hang the lumpy length of cheesecloth in the fridge or in your basement or another cool place that is less than 50 degrees and leave it for a week or 10 days to dry the yolks until they are very firm like hard cheese.
I must say, I have actually seen this. I was in the kitchen of my friend Omar de Cook Mercado, and he was in all kinds of fermenting things, and he had some of these things hanging there, and I thought, teeny tiny little cheeses, that's what it looked like. So I have, although I didn't get to taste them because he had just done it, but there it is. It can be done.
Well, it's on my agenda once we get past this harvest season, because we can do this anytime your chickens are laying.
They're laying.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to do this with eggs that, you know, that I didn't, like, I don't think I'd go to the normal grocery store and buy those eggs and do it. I don't think those are worthy of this kind of effort. But, you know, when you know the chickens and you know how clean they are and the provenance of them, that would be, and there's another even wilder one. Lana, did you read the one called Brined Eggs?
No.
Okay, it says brined eggs are immersed in salted water for about 3 weeks, a Chinese technique. You can leave the brine simple, but it's much more interesting to flavor with aromatics. And you can use duck eggs during this, too.
Are these hard-boiled to start with?
No.
Ooh.
They're raw. It's not like the pickled eggs that we're used to eating beer at the bar.
No.
This is a whole other thing. Okay, so stay tuned over the next, like, 5 or 6 months, and sooner or later, Lana and I are going to do these things, and we'll have some experience with them, and we can talk to you about it.
And we're learning about this from a book about salt, things that we can do about salt. And so, go to the sweets. What
yes,
salt? Yeah,
her final chapter of recipes is sweets, so these are things that I'm going, oh, yeah, what a good idea. So she uses a lot of miso, both red miso and white miso. So red miso, she does not use the hardcore, really dark miso. But the red miso, which is, it's white miso is lighter and sweeter. The red miso is the next least intense, and then the dark. So for the sweets, she uses either the red and or the white. So here's the list of creamy candied ginger and miso ice cream. Easy tamarind mint miso ice cream with chocolate chips. Miso espresso caramel custard.
Oh,
I think the first one I'm going to leap into is miso caramel sauce.
Miso caramel. Huh?
That sounds like a quick and
salted
quick thing
caramel-ish
do.
Is a good, yeah. Yes, okay.
And yogurt cake with ground salted nuts. Oh, she has a salted nuts recipe too okay, I'm just going to say this from memory. It's something about you soak either walnuts or almonds in salt water, then you rinse it off, and then you dry them in the oven or something.
Oh, now see?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I mean, these are techniques that I went, oh, you know, I haven't done this, but that is worth trying.
It seems like it would work.
I might try doing those kinds of nuts to put in my classic fudge recipes that I make every year at Christmas, because, you know, I have to change it up every time. I don't want my fudge to taste the same every year.
Oh, yeah, and we wouldn't eat it if it tasted the same.
No. And she's got a miso cookies and dark chocolate chips and salted almond chocolate brittle. So her nut brittles, that's another thing that's really, really good for Christmas. And another good thing, the nut brittles are a really good thing to put the finishing flaky salts on the top, too. And then she has salted drinks, which is really kind of wild. She starts by talking about how, you know, we think of margaritas for a salted drink, right? But, you know, there are other places where they, like, in the Tibetans make salt tea with butter, and she says it's like a meal in itself. And so she lists an example of a few salty cocktails. Like a dirty martini is the classic example, right?
Ooh, my goodness.
Where
my
you
goodness.
Use the olive, you know, the brine from the olive jar into the martini.
Well, that makes sense.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
See, there's so much that we can do, and it's really fun for us to get a book that we just kind of pass back and forth, and then we pass back and forth in front of the microphone here so you can enjoy it too.
Yeah, so The Miracle of Salt, Recipes and Techniques to Preserve, Ferment, and Transform Your Food. So this is, you know, for me, this is a treat because it gives me lots of, oh, let's try this and let's try that. And, you know, you expand your repertoire and your taste buds and everybody has fun.
We certainly do. This is KHOI Community Radio. This is the Donnell in the Kitchen. You can find out more at khoifm.org and support this fine community radio station. Donnell in the Kitchen. We've been talking about a new cookbook, and Don and I love books, so I have a book to share. It's not quite as full of information we might use as the salt book. I mean, we're just looking forward to trying all kinds of things, but I want to thank my friend Sarah Orngard for giving me, loaning me this book. Just, you might like this. The book is called All the President's Pastries, 25 Years in the White House, a Memoir, written by Roland Mesnier, a French chef that actually, well, it's a story.
He's a pastry chef.
He's a pastry chef. The story of his life, he started out in France as a young man, evidently, it's a really arduous process.
Oh yeah, this is the true. It does describe very well the true apprenticeship method that most chefs were trained until, you know, like almost maybe 1960 or something.
Oh yeah,
and still it still persists.
It's pretty amazing. After way he worked his way up, and this book embodies the great American dream. He worked at some of the world's top hotels, and then he got an opportunity to be the executive pastry chef to the White House. And this kind of is one of those jobs that I think he was meant for, because he just kind of blossomed in this. And believe it or not, he served in the White House under five administrations: Carter, Reagan, H.W. Bush, Clinton, and George Walker Bush. So you can imagine, I mean, besides all the politics and the world events that went around, not only in this pastry kitchen, of course there's a regular White House chef that goes along with this too, but it's a book about behind the scenes. And if you want to find out about which first lady was the most demanding, mm-hmm. or exactly how Amy Carter learned how to bake cookies, or it has all of these little things.
It's a little like that movie about the butler that was in the White House through all of the presidents and kind of.
Can you imagine all of the changes, and every change was accompanied by, trepidation, because, oh my goodness, we're going to change our whole menu. And it can be pretty, pretty amazing because
it's a high pressure job.
Because this is not just feeding the first family, which I suppose is you could get along with, but people show up, you know, at the White House and expect to be fed.
Oh yeah,
it is not just a
it's not just to feed the family thing. Sometimes you're doing dinners for 300.
State dinners.
And then
the diplomacy of the world rests on if the dessert is appealing.
It does because these visiting dignitaries expect a little pomp and circumstance, and you wouldn't think that we have royalty, but people expect that if you have a do at the White House.
Oh, it's splashy. Yeah.
Oh, I have to ask about this. This guy, Roland Mesnier, really specialized and wowed everybody with sugar sculptures.
He is from the generation of spun sugar extravaganzas.
Oh,
now,
my goodness.
Not my favorite because it really has no flavor. It's quite beautiful. It's a little bit like blowing glass. And it's sculptural and flashy and, you know, and the sort of the pastry under it, I'm sure, has to be quite good, but it's almost an afterthought. And so he kept, that was his thing, producing these sugar sculptures. It's kind of gone out of fashion, and I actually, in the Obama administration, was the first time, well, they changed all of the culinary people. They thought, well, you know, if this is America, we shouldn't be serving French food all the time.
This was after this man had retired.
And there also is a good book. So this is the pastry chef. There's also a book written by the chef who served most of the same time with him. His name, I think it's Walter Scheib or something like that, which I found also to be a very interesting read about the same subjects. And his food, he did the food part, and the French pastry chef did the desserts.
But don't
look into it for recipes, okay?
No, because this is the kind of thing that this man spent his whole life doing. I mean, of course, he'd do the pastries and the birthday cakes and the things that you would, and the croissants and all that sort of, that was done, of course. But his specialty was making swans and big baskets and
storytelling and sugar.
Yes, and if a dignitary showed up, it would be the animal of that they're the animal of the country, or he'd make a whole orange tree if needed. And sugar fruits and flowers and of course some of them would break and be quite dramatic.
Oh yes, a bit like walking on a high wire. It's quite a performance.
Goodness. But the idea of all this blown sugar, he called it pulled sugar, blown sugar, spun sugar. Really, it is all about presentation.
Yeah, I mean, it's edible technically, but this is not what the part that you're eating.
No, hardly. However, I was surprised that, this sounds like cooking for kings here, and I don't know.
It kind of is.
It is.
American style.
So this book is full of anecdotes, including the fact that they were planning a party in the lawn of the White House, a big barbecue with all kinds of fancy stuff afterwards, and of course some, I don't know, spun sugar, something or other, of course, on the day that 9/11 happened, actually. So also, plans change. I was glad to hear at the end of the book here, he actually listed the favorite desserts from the presidents and the president's family. And believe it or not, it was none of this spun sugar fancy
stuff. No, because you don't really eat that stuff. Yeah.
No, anyway. So, Jimmy Carter loved honey custard, cream caramel with honey. And he also loved silky chocolate cream pie. Ronald Reagan liked a quick chocolate mousse with crystallized ginger. And an apple souffle for George H.W. Bush. And he also liked chocolate chip cookies. Who doesn't like chocolate chip cookies? And carrot muffins for Bill Clinton. Huh? Carrot muffins? And cherry pie crumble. And for George W. Bush, actually, this sounds pretty darn good. Buttered brioche pudding with dried blueberries and lemon sauce.
Mmm.
See?
Bread pudding.
Mm. Yeah, I wouldn't mind that. Mm-hmm. And George W. Bush liked chocolate crepes, too. And George W. Bush liked rhubarb parfait.
Well, and if you're looking for some partisan
fodder in there. There is none. He's equally complimentary about all of the presidents that he served, while still noting their individual quirks.
It's true. It's a nice book for a behind-the-scenes look at things. So this is a book called All the President's Pastries, 25 Years in the White House, a memoir by Roland Mesnier, written with Christian Millard. And also, another thing he was really famous for, and we think of the White House when we think of this too, the gingerbread houses at Christmas. He kind of started doing that, and it kind of got out of control.
But considering
he absolutely loved the flair and the excess of everything, gingerbread houses are quite a deal. Not just houses. He does the whole Washington important buildings, including the Washington Monument. I don't know how high.
He's into storytelling through sponge sugar.
Yes, it is. It is. So there you go. There you go. So we've talked about some really good books today. I enjoy that. And to go out here, I've got a little news item. And tick-a-tick from our news item department here. And this is not so much a flashing news item. It's just a bit of information I think we'd like to know. It's from the New York Times by a writer named Claire Cameron, and she's Canadian, and as a college student, she spent a summer working for the forest industry, planting trees with seedling pines. Oh, what a good idea. Isn't that nice? In the 1900s, in the 1990s, she worked as a tree planter in Northern Ontario, and great idea. Not really, because we're kind of seeing the results of that now. The forests were planted not as forests, but as tree plantations, planting nothing but one species of a tree in a landscape that's been stripped of everything else is not really a forest. And what they were planting, get this, they planted something called a black spruce. And unfortunately, the people that know foresters know that they're not really all that good to plant in quantity because they're so combustibles that firefighters call them gas on a stick. Those trees are involved to burn because sometimes trees do need to burn, but not whole forests of them. So that's kind of what we're seeing.
Read the headline captures the whole idea.
Here we go, folks. We thought we were saving the planet, but we were planting a time bomb. A little note from a past tree planter. A little note from the New York Times. And so,
not all trees are equal.
Right. And there seems to be a correlation here. Can you say monocrop, Donna? There are problems when you put
monocrop.
Okay. So black spruce trees are kind of burning now, along with everything else, because there's other things, I'm sure, that are growing up there. But
the same thing happened in California. They brought in a lot of eucalyptus, and now people have had to remove them because the oils make those fires way more dangerous.
There we go. Yes. Well, so besides that bit of happy news, well, not everything is happy. We have been talking about some favorite books today. Donna, give the name of the
book. Miracle of Salt by Naomi Duguid, D-U-G-U-I-D. This is her latest book, one of many fine cookbooks, and we're going to be playing this. You'll be hearing more about this all winter long.
And I talked about All the President's Pastries by Roland Mesnier, and a lot of good stories of behind the scenes at the White House. Yes. So, if you can't get enough of us, Donna, we have a podcast. Tell
folks.
We
do indeed. You can listen to us at the radio twice on Tuesdays and then in the archives. Or wherever you get your podcast, you just go put in Donna Lana, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, one word, and kitchen, and we will pop right up.
And we do, too. Yes, we do. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thank you for joining us today. Good music by the Barn Owl Band. Today you heard the Gaspé Reel, Reel Traditionnel, and the Reel de Saint-Antoine, a little French-Canadian stuff for French pastries, I guess, yes. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
And we had Fine Engineering by Eric B., who you can hear other ways on this station, too. Eat good food and enjoy life.